What are we starting with this week?
A wee comment.
Spotify update.
A wee comment? No, we did that last week. Luke, what did you say?
A Spotify update.
No.
A wee email.
No, we don't do emails.
A review. A wee review.
Apple podcast review.
Well done, Jamp. You're absolutely correct. We are doing an Apple podcast review.
Thank you.
So this one is from Sarah Jane Jake. It's a 5-star review. It says, I love this podcast so much, still working on watching all of the past episodes. It's fun to listen to and makes me sound so much smarter. Isn't that nice?
That is lovely.
That's very nice.
That's lovely.
Thank you.
So if you want to look smart in front of your friends, listen to Sci Guys.
That sounds like good advice to me. Let's start the show.
Wait, do we have a question?
Oh, what is your favorite cryptid? That's the question for this week. Get down in the comments, answer that question. What's your favorite cryptid?
I don't know what
Let's
that means.
Let's start the show.
I don't know what that means either. Let's start the show.
Hello and welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jemp and Luke Cutforth.
Hello!
Why, hello there.
This week, we're talking about the Loch Ness Monster.
Oh!
Very good. Yeah. Good old Nessie.
Is it real?
Well, maybe. That's what we're finding out today.
Oh.
Because I've got a little science report on the Loch Ness Monster and whether or not she is real.
A yes or a no would be too quick an episode, Luke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is the Loch Ness Monster a she?
Yeah, Nessie.
Nessie.
Yeah. She's always called a girl,
Vanessa.
Right?
No. No. Call me progressive, but I consider Nessie a gender-neutral name.
It's not very progressive to misgender the Loch Ness Monster, Luke.
Oh, no! I'm cancelled!
Yeah. So, Loch Ness is a lake. It's in the Highlands. You know that? Yeah? You know all this?
I didn't, yeah, but I've learned now.
Biggest, yeah, it's one of the biggest in the UK. It is 240 metres deep and about 36 kilometres long. And it's got the most fresh water of any lake in Britain.
The most fresh?
The largest volume of fresh water.
Oh, so no
Which
meth.
Is surprising, as Nessie's been pissing in it for centuries.
Actually, Nessie gets out, pisses in another lake, and then gets back into that one. No, it's got over 7 billion cubic meters of water. So there's a lot of water in there, which is why we might not have found the Loch Ness Monster quite yet.
It's too much to go through.
Do you guys know where the Loch Ness Monster comes from? Don't say Loch Ness.
Scotland.
Legend.
Myth.
You know what? I realize I put the bar way too low for that one. So the Loch Ness Monster myth.
Her mother.
Ooh.
The Loch Ness Monster myth.
The Loch Ness mother.
So the myth first came about in the 6th century. Apparently it was an Irish monk called Columba, who became a Catholic saint, was supposed to have stopped Nessie as she was attacking a swimmer. And basically this saint just chased the Loch Ness monster away. I do love saints in stories though, because saints are always doing stuff like that, you know?
What was chasing the Irish away monk monsters doing in Scotland?
I don't know. They're close.
Is this why this person is a saint?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. This is a real saint. This is a patron saint of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, it seems so. Columba. Catholic saint. But bear in mind,
and it's based on a story that's not, well, pardon me if we find out the Loch Ness Monster is true, but not true.
Sorry, Luke, hold on. can I just double check what you're saying there? Are you surprised that a story about a Catholic saint isn't true?
Well, Corey, I don't know what you are trying to suggest here. But what I mean is, I'm surprised that there is a story of this Catholic saint that is so, now again, pardon me if we find out something about the Loch Ness Monster in this story, demonstrably false.
Isn't it, who's
it's like there being a saint that was like met with dinosaurs or something.
You know. Who's the patron saint of Wales?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Prince William.
I didn't know Wales had a Patreon.
Okay, right.
Is it Ashley Muller?
No, it's been easy. Yeah,
my apologies.
Saints are known for like slaying dragons and whatnot.
And getting
the snakes out of different. Yeah.
Well, the Catholic Church has some answering to do then, doesn't it?
Saint Nicholas is supposed to have given gifts to all the children in the world.
No, Saint Nicholas really did that. He gave gifts to like the local area.
Yeah, and now Santa Claus gives gifts to everyone in the world. I'm just saying that there is an element of myth with all saints.
Absurdity.
This is par for the course. And also, look, I'm going to put it out there. I don't think everything the Bible says Jesus did is 100% true. I'm putting that out there. I'm going out on a limb. Maybe the Bible has some things that are embellished.
He definitely walked on water, though, didn't he?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
He walked Can't on take some that ice. From us.
He walked on some ice. Oh, that's what he did.
That was it.
Yeah.
Like penguins.
Yes, Jesus was a penguin.
He gave 5,000 people a crumb of bread.
I didn't say how much bread I gave them. I just shared it.
Yeah, it doesn't say how full they were. Yeah. I think it actually.
They all still starved to death.
They'd all actually.
I think it does say they are all quite full. Actually, at the end.
That's because they'd all eaten before they came. You know, they'd all had a very large lunch.
They'd all filled up on bread.
Well, and Jesus elsewhere. Was like, no, here's the bread, and they were like, no, thank you. I've already had plenty of bread today.
Oh, I'll take a crumb. Stomach. I'll take a crumb. Yeah.
They were all pescatarians as well, which is why the fish managed to go around everyone.
Because they all just gave it a little kiss and passed it on.
Just, oh, no, not for me, thank you. No, thanks. No, yeah. So the Loch Ness Monster first came about in a legend from the 6th century, which is older than America. Just want to put that out there.
Wow.
And the legend apparently stuck around, well, obviously older than Captain America. Is that what you said?
No, I just said, take that, America. Oh. But sure.
And Captain America.
Oh, yes.
Actually, I think you'll find Captain America originates from a 3rd century Catholic saint.
Before America.
Yes. That's where it got its name.
From Captain America. America after him.
Right. So this legend
Steve.
Gets...
Patron Steve Saint America. Steve.
Steve America.
So this legend stuck around for a long time, and apparently in the 1930s there were newspapers reporting on Nessie sightings, and you know people have made money from this. There's all these sort of different businesses that have sprung up around Nessie. You can get Nessie merch in different places in Scotland. You know, all the tourist traps. Mm-hmm. So and you know, people go into Loch Ness because of the legend of the Loch Ness Monster. Presumably brings in a fair amount of money. So Nessie sightings kind of aren't super... I mean, they're not uncommon, but, you know, they're not happening all the time. But when they do happen, often it turns out to be a hoax or a log or... mostly those two, really. Hoaxes and logs. That's what they mostly turn out to be. Although there was a famous photo. You guys have seen that famous photo of Nessie,
yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah? And they built a big like thing.
Yeah.
And put it in the water.
Do you know what that was?
No, the elephant. I can't remember.
No, so elephant, that's interesting. We'll get to that in a second. But this photo was actually a toy submarine and some wood putty.
What? Yeah.
Someone was very cross because they were made fun of in a newspaper for saying that there was a Nessie sighting. So they faked a photo to stick it to the man.
Right, using you've proved a toy their submarine. Point, haven't you?
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah. And no, you say elephants. Elephants were one of the explanations that people had, that there could have been traveling circuses and they let the elephants out to swim in the loch. And, is you know, what you think is a head of a monster
is
actually
trunk.
A nice little elephant trunk.
Yeah.
Just sticking out. Like, look at them breathing.
Yeah, because they do look kind of like... It is like a Diplodocus kind of look for Nessie, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, generally.
Love that look on her.
Plesiosaur is the most common sort of... is the most common sort of explanation, dinosaur explanation for Nessie.
Ah.
Yeah, which, again...
Because it's a water dinosaur.
Yes, it's a big water dinosaur.
As opposed to a Diplodocus, which is not.
Well, actually, interestingly, those long-necked dinosaurs, there are theories that they were semi-aquatic, and so they would walk across the water, they'd have their head stuck out, and that's how they managed to maintain their massive size, and it was beneficial. So instead of, like, you know, doing it to reach up for trees, because apparently they ate lower leaves as well... it was because they had their heads at the water. That's not fact. That's just one idea, by the way.
So their neck is just there. A big snorkel.
More or less,
yeah.
Your neck is the snorkel tube.
Yeah.
Just like with snorkels, when we cut our heads off and stick them on top of the snorkel so we can still breathe.
Luke, please don't go snorkeling. Just...
Well, this will be the last one.
I clearly haven't, Corey, because my head is still on my neck.
It's a once in a lifetime experience, I hate.
It's to die for, really. Yeah. So, so that photo was published. It turned out being a toy submarine and some putty. And like I said, there's lots of different explanations. There was the elephant one that I just mentioned. There was the sort of, is it plesiosaur? Did I say plesiosaur?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, some kind of dinosaur. And apparently there's another theory that it's branches that have fallen into the loch. Lots of different ideas for this. But we've started looking, right? We've started looking into see whether, you know, there was any Loch Ness monster. And anything we tried, nothing really comes up, you know? We've used sonar. Apparently we can't find anything using sonar. That was in 2003. But still, you know, the legend of Nessie persists. And so I'll go through sort of maybe, should I go through a bit of a timeline? Through a little bit of a timeline.
Go on.
So, as I said, back in 1933, there were sort of, you know, people like really caught on with Nessie. That's when this more sort of modern interpretation of Nessie really caught on, 1933. And then that famous photograph that we spoke about came about in 1934. And then in the 60s, there were videos. There was like a video, someone caught a video of Nessie on film. But it turns out after like sort of looking into this photo that it was just a fishing boat. Unfortunately, just a fishing boat. And in 1962 to 1972, there was the Loch Ness Investigation Bureau, and they spent 10 years hunting for Nessie.
10 years.
They were putting cameras around the locks. They were using lights, infrared cameras, submarines, basically everything that they could try. And they could not find anything. They did have something come up on sonar that they couldn't explain twice in 1962 and 1968, but no sighting of Nessie really. And then in 1975. The Nessie had been in Doctor Who, had been in sort of basically had become popular culture, right? Everybody who was anybody knew about the Loch Ness monster. And then, you know, in the 80s, people continued to sort of look for Nessie. And then in 2003, the BBC funded a search using sonar beams, found nothing. And then, you know, 2009, she showed up on Google Earth, supposedly. There was like a mysterious sort of image on Google Earth. And then in 2016, we used sonar again. We found something quite interesting. We actually found a Loch Ness monster in Loch Ness.
What?
Yeah, it was a prop built for a Sherlock Holmes film, which had sunk 50 years beforehand. So
it wasn't real.
No, it wasn't real. Well, it was real, just not alive. Or an animal.
Or a monster.
Yeah.
Or Nessie.
Just a prop. And then in 2019, this is what I want to talk about. In 2019, a man named Neil Gemmell, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, went ahead and did this massive survey of the waters of Loch Ness to try and find Nessie, supposedly. So... that's what we're going to be talking about today. Neil Gemmell's search for the Loch Ness Monster. Because this is something that came up while I was just looking for topics. And apparently, you might have heard of this. About a year or two ago, there were lots of articles going out about people finding out, scientists finding out, what the Loch Ness Monster could actually be. So, did you guys hear about that at all?
No.
No.
No? No. No? Essentially, Gemmell is a New Zealand Kiwi, is a Kiwi scientist. Not a scientist for kiwis, the fruit or the bird. He is from New Zealand. Need to be clear about that. He's from New Zealand. And he has done similar sort of studies before. I'll get into that in a bit. So essentially what they did was they went to Loch Ness. That just about 2 days before they got there, there were a few sightings of the Loch Ness monster. So, you know, you'd expect that if the Loch Ness monster was actually kicking about, that they'd be in a good position to find her, given that she'd been sighted a couple of days before. So what they did they got there in 2018 in June, and then took 250 water samples from the surface of the water, from way down deep in the water, and that was over a period of 2 weeks. And then they took that, the DNA that they found in the water, they amplified that, probably using PCR, which we've spoken about before. So they amplified their DNA up, so they've got lots of it to sort of study. And they then basically sequenced the DNA to find out what was in the water, right? So they were finding out what kind of animals and plants were in, like, sort of in and around Loch Ness. And this is, so Gemmell said that the sample showed which animals and plants had interacted with the local environment in the previous 24 to 48 hours, right? And again, given there was a sighting of Nessie not 2 days before, you'd expect her to show up. But what did they find? What do you think they found?
Lots of fish and lots of plants and nothing else.
Not much Nessie.
Well, not nothing else. They found more than just fish and plants, interestingly.
Oh.
Yeah, so here's what they found, right? They didn't find any giant reptiles or dinosaurs or anything like that. No monsters of that kind of caliber. They did, there were other sort of explanations for Nessie, like giant sturgeons or catfish or even sort of sharks. But there was not that much, DNA from any of those either. There was no shark DNA. There was no sturgeon or catfish DNA, based on the samples that they took. And what they did find though, was a lot of eel DNA, from eels, you know, the long sort of like wiggly fish.
When you say that there were no large reptiles.
Yes.
Are you able to tell from DNA what size the thing is that gave the DNA?
So no large reptiles in the sense that DNA from a reptile species that is
no
large.
No known large reptiles.
A Komodo dragon, for example, is a large reptile.
So no known large reptiles.
Yeah.
But what do you mean DNA. By that? So like there was no DNA for any reptiles that we are aware of that are large.
Yes. Yeah.
So what if there was an unknown large reptile? Would you be able to tell from the DNA that it was an unknown large reptile?
You'd probably be able to tell that it was a reptile from the DNA.
But it might be like a little newt or something, assuming they're net reptiles. They're probably not.
They're amphibious.
But yeah, they are. Amphibious, yeah.
Yeah. So, I think they're amphibians, yeah. So, no. They didn't find any reptile DNA. They didn't find any reptiles at all in the water. They didn't find any reptile DNA at all in the water. And this is the thing, that's an interesting question, because that's literally what they go on to say, that they didn't find, they found a lot of eel DNA, and they can't tell the size of the individual animal from the DNA, obviously, because the DNA is fairly consistent.
Yeah,
but they know that eels can grow to be quite large, so there was eel DNA at pretty much every single place that they looked, right? Because they took 250 samples of different parts of Loch Ness and then looked at the DNA in there, and there was eel DNA in most of those 250 samples. And because there is so much DNA there was so much eel DNA, you can't tell the size of the eel from the DNA. But what he did say was that we can't discount the possibility that there may be giant eels in Loch Ness. Therefore, we can't discount the possibility that what people see and believe is the Loch Ness monster might be a giant eel.
Eels.
Yeah, it could just be eels, right? But it wasn't just eel DNA that they found. They found DNA from humans, dogs, sheep, cattle, deer, badgers, rabbits, voles, and birds. Now,
big badgers?
I don't think it's a big badger.
Okay.
Bear in mind that the DNA that they're finding, this is DNA that's kind of shed from an animal, right? So you shed DNA all the time, you know, when you get your skin cells off and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you're shedding your DNA. Yeah. A little bit of DNA gone there. So it's not just what's specifically in the water, it's also what's in and around the water. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why they found all that. So as I said, they found a lot of eels. They can't tell what size the eels are, but the eels were the sort of the DNA that they found. Most of it was eels made up the largest proportion of DNA that they found, essentially, right? So a lot of the DNA that they found was eels. There were more eel DNA than there was DNA of any of the other animals.
Mm-hmm. Was there any unknown, mysterious DNA unknown to science?
Not as far as I'm aware. Not as far as I'm aware. This is the thing. I do want to talk about this, because this is interesting to me. When I looked into this, I always go ahead and try and find the original study. there were about 10 articles. I mean, there's tons of articles, but maybe 10 from sources that I would say are somewhat reputable when talking about science. So like, you know, the BBC, Scientific American, all those sort of places where I'll look to see what, to see if they've got anything extra that's been added or anything, any interesting take.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I looked at all of those. Life science as well. Not a single one of them linked back to a study, because there wasn't, I don't think there is a published study. I went on a search here. I went looking at Neil Gemmell's, I went to his website. I went to the list of his publications. I looked through all of them, and he publishes a lot of stuff. His name is on a lot of papers.
Yeah.
Could not find anything. I went to his website, looked at the sort of our studies from his lab, because his lab were the ones that did this survey. There is not a published paper, as far as I can tell, on this. So
this is a press release.
Well, there was a documentary about it.
Oh, okay.
There was a documentary about it. There was a press release. I went through so much, honestly. I went through his Twitter. I went through everything. It's kind of a press release, yeah. In fact, yeah, there was actually a press event, I think, prior to the documentary coming out. But when it comes to sort of the nitty gritty, I can't actually go in and look at the data and answer all of these questions for you. Mm. But I'm basically off of what Neil has said himself. And I've gone to his Twitter as well to see some of his explanations for XYZ. And he said, oh, this article is good for X, that article is good for Y, in terms of sort of what the articles are saying about his work.
That's disappointing. Come on, Neil, try harder.
So, yeah. So again, like, this is the thing. I've got a little sort of an image here that gives some information on this. It's from the University of Otago in New Zealand. We were partly, I think this study was carried out for them. It was from Neil's lab, which I think is in the University of Otago. I'm not entirely sure how it works, but they were involved in some way. So this sort of, what's the word for when there's pictures and information and it's in a nice visual format? There's a specific word for it. An infographic. Yes, that's it. Thank you very much, Luke. So there's some information from this. I'll just go into it. There's, it's very great. There's a little drawing of a plesiosaur, a little drawing of a shark, and a little drawing of a catfish. They're all circled with a line through them. There's no plesiosaur. There's no shark. There's no catfish.
Ah, very visual. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. The cross makes all the difference.
Exactly. The largest known European eel is 6 feet long, right? Which is about my height. Think of how tall you expect me to be. And that's how long the eel is, right?
Ugh, I would not want to meet that eel.
No. I mean, you wouldn't want to meet me either. That is...
Well, no, it's probably worse than meeting remotely.
But really, an eel my length. It'd be quite thick as well. But the sort of estimated size of this Loch Ness eel would be, they've estimated to be about 12 feet, which is about twice the length of the largest known European eel. Now, bear in mind, it is perfectly possible to find animals that are larger than what you expect. I mean, think about when we found the colossal squid, or the giant squid, and then the colossal squid sitting at the bottom of the ocean. You know, those, we spoke about that in our In Too Deep episode. Which number was that, Jamp?
22. I got that right. No, I remember now, 22.
Amazing. I love that skill. So yeah, we spoke of that in our, I think we touched on them in our In Too Deep episode. And yeah, the thing is that it could just really be a large eel, because eels kind of match with the description of Nessie. Obviously the issue here is this eel would have to be bigger than any known eel.
Yeah.
But then it also says that seals and sturgeons could also account for some of the sightings. It's just that they don't often get to Loch Ness. Mm-hmm. So that's why they probably didn't find any DNA. But some of the sightings could be seals or sturgeon or, I mean, anything sort of like that. Because there's lots of stuff going in and out of Loch Ness. It's a massive, massive loch.
Yeah.
So they're not really sure. They don't really have a definitive answer for what the Loch Ness monster is. I mean, maybe it's an eel. Maybe people are just making it up. But do you not think it?
I don't know why, but it's so disappointing if it turned out it was an eel.
Really?
Something just so disappointing about it. Doesn't even have any legs. It's just like wriggling around Loch Ness, and we've built an entire industry and tourism out of this. It's just like a big eel.
I think it's less disappointing than it being nothing.
I think a giant 12-foot eel is pretty cool.
That's pretty exciting.
Because it'd have to be pretty thick.
The biggest eel ever.
Like, that'd be about the size of this, I mean, just curries. A bit smaller than this room that I'm in.
And I wouldn't want to make two curries.
No.
No.
Oh, could you imagine?
One on top of the other.
Wriggling around. Slimy.
They'd be thick as well, right? For an eel 12 feet long, it'd be very, very girthy.
Yeah. Okay, you're convincing me. I'm excited now. Thank you for selling the large wriggly eel to me.
I think any explanation for the Loch Ness Monster would be fun and interesting, to be totally honest, you know? Because it's this case of there's this myth and we find the true reason for it. And often we think that, oh, well, the real reason for things is boring. Outside of fantasy, life is boring. But life is really interesting. I think it'd be really cool that if there was this giant eel that was living in Loch Ness that people have built this whole myth around because no one's seen an eel that big. Bear in mind, we're not saying that is what it is. In fact, I really need to caveat this with no one has said that it is a giant eel. They just said that there's a lot of eel DNA, and if an eel could get to be that big, it could be that that's what people are seeing. But it's not a case of that. This is what it is. This is the most likely thing. It's just the least unlikely thing. Beyond, I think people are mostly just seeing logs and other things and making it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just think it's because every popular conception of the Loch Ness Monster has been like a large kind of shape moving through, like, ominously through the water. Mm-hmm. Whereas I feel like eels probably wriggle pretty quickly. That's a very different sort of conception of the Loch Ness Monster to the one that I believe I've been sold, at least. And I went to Loch Ness and I have done all the tourist stuff in my childhood. And it's definitely always been like a kind of, like I say, in my mind anyway, in my experience, it's always been like, you know, that kind of like plesiosaur type.
The thin neck and the head.
Long neck that pokes out the water with a little head on the end.
Big body with some fins.
But has anyone ever actually seen some fins, or have they just assumed that? Do you know what I mean?
They've assumed and the fins, I think.
The myth, has the myth sort of built, is the myth affected what people are seeing, you know?
It's true.
Also, you say that an eel would wriggle quite quickly, but I think a 6-foot eel wouldn't be wriggling that fast.
A 12-foot eel.
That's true.
And if it's a 12-foot eel, then, which again, twice the size of any known eel, then but that's not really the point. What do you guys think about this? I do want to talk about this because this is received funding, not government funding, but I think a lot of people sort of donated money to this sort of privately. What do you guys think about spending this kind of money on this kind of science?
Well, I do find it odd when you say the BBC funded a sonar thing. I'm assuming for a documentary of some sort, which obviously would do very well. Mm-hmm. But not to completely rule it out, but I'm pretty sure this is just some crap to increase tourism and a fun story to tell your children to scare them.
Oof.
Yeah.
Oof.
Sorry, Scotland. I do love you, but I don't think. I feel like we would have found it by now.
Well, this is the thing, though. This study was done by, well, basically New Zealand, the University of Otago. So there is a reason behind it. It is a little bit more than just tourism, although I might have misled you a little bit. I was letting you buy into the story of the Loch Ness Monster a little more than maybe I should have. So,
By the way, I'd just like to tell you that I did Google 6-foot eel and I am now thoroughly terrified of big eels. This is horrible.
Let me do that.
It's horrible. No, I'm just looking at this horrible video. It looks like a catfish, but it's then like 6 foot long.
Yeah, don't look at them. People have said...
I've looked at me.
I read stories of people that had been out in those waters and seen giant eels and stuff like that. And honestly, it's just...
Ooh.
This is horrifying.
I've just developed a phobia, Corey. I always imagine an eel to be like almost like a tadpole, that kind of like slimy thing. But it's like an animal. It's like it's got like, you know, thick skin. It's not just a kind of goopy jelly that wriggles around.
Yeah, I picture eels as being maybe this long, maybe just over a foot long, like little skinny wriggly boys, right? But no, eels can be, like you say, big. And their jaws as well. Like a moray eel, you do not want to be, you don't want to be grabbed by one of them. Yeah, like eels are bloody horrifying little things, especially when they're massive. But I did mislead you a little bit with this episode, right? I did mislead you with the reason for this. So does anything strike you about how they were looking for sort of examples of animals?
Well, they're assuming that the Loch Ness Monster is DNA-based life form and not an alien come from space and living in the Loch Ness. Is that not the answer you wanted to hear, Corey? You're looking somewhat
fatal error.
Disappointed.
Honestly, no, it's not the answer that I wanted to hear.
I thought that's exactly what you wanted to hear.
Really?
Yeah. Well, that is a flaw in the study of how they looked for animals. They looked for DNA, and that's an assumption they've made that the Loch Ness Monster will have DNA. That is an assumption. That's the question you asked.
Okay, maybe I asked my question poorly, because that was not at all what I meant. So more what I'm talking about is that they were using DNA to look for the Loch Ness Monster, right? They were using DNA to sort of figure out what animals were present there. And I think what's interesting about that is that they were using environmental DNA. So they weren't going and sampling all of the animals in the loch, or the animals and plants in the loch. They were taking the water and sampling the DNA from that. Mm-hmm. Now, you might not know, that is actually a really interesting thing to do, right? So it's not been around, the idea of environmental DNA, or eDNA as I'll start calling it now. It's not incredibly old. It's a little bit more recent. Obviously, our ability to sequence DNA and amplify DNA has really come, is relatively recent in human history. You know, it's become a lot easier. Yeah. In the past sort of few decades. And that means that now what we can do is essentially, instead of having to, you know, look at animals directly, we can look for the evidence of them that they leave when they sort of, you know, leave their DNA mm-hmm. behind. So you don't need to be looking for animals specifically. You can just sample if they're in water. You can just sample where they are. And that's a lot of what Gemmell's lab does, right? If you look at a lot of his papers, a lot of them are about eDNA. And the sort of looking at population based on, there was actually a particular one that's looking at populations of environments using eDNA, which is really interesting, right? Because, I mean, from this one, we've seen that they've extrapolated that there are lots of eels or a number of large eels in Loch Ness, given that there was a lot of eel DNA found, right? So instead of having to like actually count the number of eels or do any sort of direct method, you can just take samples from lots of different places in the lake, which is honestly really cool. It is really cool that you can do that.
But it doesn't tell you anything about the number of animals, because it could be like, if it's mostly eels, it could be thousands of eels, little eels, or it could be one just like 50-foot eel that's just shedding all sorts of DNA all over the place.
Well, then if you really wanted to do that, then what you could do is just take the DNA samples that you've got and compare them to each other. See if you
clone them, breed them.
Sure. You could do that also. no, I mean, you could
compare
the DNA.
The same DNA exactly will be from one animal. Okay, right, good. Yeah. Yep,
you could see how many, you know, you could see, you could look at the bio, you could look at the diversity of the genetic diversity of those animals as well. Yeah. But so the whole point
of lots of little eels all sticking together like like nanobots and acting like one giant eel.
Look, that is literally a Pokemon.
Yeah, well, there you go.
You've 100% just reinvented
that's
a Pokemon.
That's monster. That's what it is.
The wishy-washy.
Oh, wait, not Onyx.
What?
Not Onyx.
No, Onyx is made of just rocks.
Yeah, that's what I thought you meant. I don't know what you're on about then.
There is a Pokemon from Sun and Moon called Wishy-Washy, it's got an ability which I think after level 22, if its HP decreases to half, I believe this is all from memory, it will enter its schooling form, which is basically a giant fish made up of lots of different little fish.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
like Thousand Ants from Rick and Morty.
Yes, I love that character. I actually did some maths on it to see if 1 million ants could fill up that volume. Yes. I can't remember what the answer was. I don't think it matches up. I think it's just really? A cool number. What?
I did the math.
It's hard to, do you know what's really hard? It's hard to find what the volume of an ant is, okay? Try and find the volume of an ant online. It is not easy, okay? It is.
We should take one and then hollow it out and then fill it up. And we can test.
Corey, I Googled volume of one ant and it says, an average worker ant it weighs between 1 and 5 milligrams. Its volume is 10 millimeters cubed. Literally, what kind of ant is top that? Of Google.
What kind of ant is that? Maybe it's the volume of a person. Oh, hold on. No, there was some difficulty in finding this out. Hold on.
Well, someone's done the math. What volume would 1 million ants occupy? And would it be comparable to the volume occupied by a human? Is this you posting, Corey, on Reddit?
Hey, no. Okay, look, probably that Reddit post was not there when I first did it. Like,
it was in 2017. Fair.
Yeah, I probably did it when the episode came out.
Okay.
Yeah, bang on when it came out. I don't know, man. I don't know. All I know is that I tried to figure it out myself and I can't remember the answer. I don't think 1 million ants fits into one. I don't think 1 million ants according, is comparable to one person.
According to this Reddit, it depends on the ant and the human.
Yeah, obviously.
Very unhelpful answer.
God, I love 1 million ants. What a great character. Anyway, moving on. How did he have sex? Never mind.
Each ant has sex separately and then all their babies form a new 1 million ant.
But only the queen could give birth to the...
Oh, I don't know anything about the mating patterns of ants, Corey. You can answer this one for yourself.
with most insects like that, I can't remember the name for it, but it's like, it's similar to... Actually, I think naked mole rats do a similar thing wherein there is like sort of one... queen that basically lays all of the eggs or has all of the offspring. There's that happens with a lot of insects. I can't quite remember the name for that sort of pattern of behavior or biology. But back to the Loch Ness Monster. Yeah? Shall we jump back to that?
Yes.
So, have you figured out why they might have done this study?
To find out if the Loch Ness Monster is
no.
real?
No, okay, right. Let me get back.
I mean, that's what I was thinking.
Let me do a recap, right? And we'll see. So,
okay. Right.
Neil Gemmell, his sort of research team, his lab, does a lot of work with eDNA. And in this study, they were looking for the Loch Ness Monster, which they knew they probably weren't going to find, using eDNA techniques.
Were they promoting eDNA?
Here's a quote
and
from
their company.
Not their company so much as just the techniques, right? So here's a
scientists
quote.
Scientists are so cool. They literally I had this cool thing. You guys should also do it. I'm going to spend a lot of time promoting it, even though it doesn't necessarily get me anything.
Yeah.
Cool. Good work.
Right?
Good work.
Here is a quote from, Gamble. He said, environmental DNA is a very powerful and surprisingly elegant way to understand our rich world. And then he went on to say, if you like, this has been a great big science con. We've been talking about the science the entire time, and we're using the monsters as bait.
Ooh.
Essentially. Right? It's pretty cool.
That's very good.
Right? I started looking into this story. I was like, oh, Loch Ness Monster, eel, let's see what it is. It'll be something silly. And it turned out to be something really interesting. It's using, it was using environmental DNA, and basically showcasing the wonders of this sort of technology, this method of looking at like sort of populations and then the sort of landscape, and just use the Loch Ness Monster as a big old advertising tool for it.
Yeah.
So
fantastic.
What you're saying is that people use discussion of the Loch Ness Monster to promote their own thing, which is why you can go to patreon.com/SciGuys to support this show.
Patreon.com/SciGuys.
It was all ruse. We just wanted to promote the show.
Very good. And if you pay enough at patreon.com/SciGuys, we will have our own hunt for the Loch Ness Monster. We'll do it. We'll go up there.
Yeah, we will.
We'll definitely
I'll
go to the Loch
Ness. I'll put my camera in my waterproof camera bag. I'll get a wetsuit on and I'll go for a swim with the giant terrifying eels.
And then we'll have to find a new host for the podcast after Luke is eaten by a giant eel.
I already Googled, do eels eat humans? And apparently they don't. So
okay.
Good.
Well, so long as you don't go snorkeling doing it, that would be really, really terrible.
Well, yeah.
just go scuba diving, please.
I think so.
So
I need to keep my head.
I'm just going to read out some more quotes from Neil Gemmell, because he's got some good quotes here, and you'll find these are all the sort of articles that I put in the description. Again, it was really frustrating for me, actually, that I couldn't find the source material for this. It was it's a very frustrating thing that I had to take this from his interviews and articles and whatnot. But he did have a lot of great quotes, as I said. So he went on and said, "I came into this with a view that there probably wasn't a monster. I wanted to understand the biodiversity of Loch Ness, and we've done that very well." So that was really the goal. I mean, it was just to look at, it was just to do a study of Loch Ness. And in doing that, he managed to just hop onto the Loch Ness monster and use that, which I think is fantastic. And honestly, it sucks that science in our world right now has to be profitable or marketable in some way to be, to be basically funded. Mm-hmm. But it is wonderful to see someone do that so well. And it is very useful for shows like this. I mean, I love it when you've got a great story around something that is just, I think this whole story is just really indicative of what this podcast is as well. Yeah. It's basically using a really catchy, interesting sort of hook to
get people interested.
Yeah, to get people interested, just to talk about something that is just some science, just some interesting science.
Then slipping in the actual interesting science in there.
Yeah.
The real stuff.
You think you're having fun. You think you're enjoying yourself, but actually you're learning.
But oh my God, you've learned.
We're putting information in your brain,
So Corey, what do you think? Do you think that the Loch Ness Monster is real? Being the Scottish person of the podcast.
Look, I am a man of science. And while I believe that the Loch Ness Monster probably isn't real, I also want to believe that the Loch Ness Monster is real. So I hold both of those ideas in my head simultaneously. The Loch Ness Monster is also real.
Sounds like probably what most people who believe in the Loch Ness Monster actually do.
Yeah.
The Loch Ness doublethink, Corey.
Yeah, doublethink. Who doesn't love a little bit of doublethink? I love it. Yeah. Look, the Loch Ness Monster is probably not real, but also she totally is. No, I very much, this is the thing. I'm very into lore. I'm very much into that sort of
stuff. Scotland lore.
I'm into lore and mythology and things. So I do really enjoy the idea of this sort of mythology. I'm really into cryptids. I'm really into these sort of creatures that, are sort of from mythology and from folklore and probably aren't real, but we love to keep that sort of idea alive. Like Bigfoot, Sasquatch, that kind of idea. Or a Jersey Devil or Chupacabra or Yetis. Categorically, probably not real. But really interesting to one, come up with explanations how they could be real, and two, just to have fun talking about the sort of mythology around them, So whether or not they're real, I still think they're fun. What do you guys think?
I think the Loch Ness Monster is real. Not physically, but in our hearts.
I just wish we got
Santa Claus argument.
In our hearts.
The Loch Ness Monster is a piece of software running on all of our brains.
That is literally it.
Just like Santa Claus.
You tell children it's real.
What have you got to say? What do you think about the Loch Ness Monster?
I just wish we got to the bottom of it.
I just don't like not knowing.
And we can't prove non-existence.
Yeah. Here's the thing. These kinds of stories are always going to live. Because, like you said, Champ, you can't prove non-existence. Until you find a Sasquatch, people are not going to stop talking about Sasquatch.
Exactly.
Exactly. You cannot say to someone that fully believes that Bigfoot exists, or that Yetis exist, or that the Loch Ness Monster exists, or that El Chupacabra exists. You can't say to them, they don't exist. Because what they're looking for you to do is to prove categorically that they don't. Mm-hmm. And unless we take a giant net with tiny little holes and just drag it through Loch Ness, or completely empty it with drinking straws, drain it all out, and then go hunting around the bottom, we're not gonna be able to prove it. And even then, if we were to do that, they would still say, well, she knew and she got away.
She got out.
She went for a wee in the nearby loch.
She came back and she was confused why it was all drained. Yeah.
She filled it up again with her pee. And that's what she does.
I would love for her to exist, but I'd rather know about it or know why how the myth started, Why the myth started.
Oh, we know why the myth started.
I'd love to know. Oh, because of this patron saint.
Yeah.
I'd love to know what the psychological quirk is that you're describing there, Corey, about how we have a belief and we require evidence that the belief is untrue, even though that is, you can't prove negative. What's the scientific phrase for that?
No, you. I mean, you can't prove a negative is fair.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'd love to know what the psychological trait behind that is. Obviously, there's the financial economic incentive to perpetuate the myth, and that obviously keeps it going. But there are other myths that don't have quite so much of a economic incentive. And I'm sure there are other people, like, for example, you don't have any economic incentive to perpetuate the myth of Nessie not being in the tourist trade around Loch Ness. And so what is it about our minds and the way we've evolved that mean that we gravitate towards, oh, but what if it is true? What if?
I think it could we just be like mythology and stories, right?
But why? Because a computer wouldn't love mythology and stories. So what is it? Is it because it's fun?
I think it's fun.
But why is it fun? What's the psychological thing going on there that means it's fun?
There's like an allure to a truth that is undiscovered, you know?
Well, yeah, there is that. But I also think that our world is built around stories, right? That's how we understand everything. We understand things not as they are. We understand things as stories sort of imitating how they are. And when you have a story that is larger than life, it can make you feel like you're living in a more interesting world.
Yeah.
So a good story, I don't know. I think a good story, we've always loved good stories. We've always loved good stories. And I guess that's just because stories are how we understand the world. So a good story makes you feel like you're living in a better world.
Also get confused between when something's a good story. A little bit of us goes, well, if it's a good story, if it follows some whatever underlying structure it is that makes a story a good story, for example, you have like the three-act hero structure, like the hero's journey in storytelling. The mistake we make is that if it sort of, I guess, rhymes with some internalized idea we hold of what is a good story, we then make the mistake that, well, then it must be true. Or we hold on to the possibility that it must be true. And similarly, we also go, well, the Loch Ness Monster story has been around for so long. It must be true because it wouldn't have survived for so long. And those are sort of psychological quirks that are, I think, science is starting to help us see through. But for many, many years, that before we had science to test stuff, that kind of worked on people, didn't it? It's kind of like, just like, well-crafted bullshit.
Do you reckon? Yeah. Do you think people might make the mistake, and they might wrongfully assume that if it wasn't real, we would have been able to prove it? But of course, we can't. But people might assume that you can.
I think you're spot on there. I think as you see this a lot with Christians saying, "Well, if God isn't real, then how have you not managed to prove it?" And it's like, "Well, hold on there, chap. I think you're the one that's got to prove this one, given that, you're the one that's saying this thing is happening that no one can see or whatever. I feel like you've got to prove it. The burden of proof is on you." So I think people misunderstand how proving things works.
Oh, 100%.
Sort of intuitively. And that makes sense. I mean, I think we all do that. And on what Luke was saying, I think, bias is something that is that exists in people still. Confirmation bias, is something. The thing is, people are inclined to believe what they already believe. You're not going to go looking for information that disproves your own belief. And that's something that I really have to struggle with when I'm making episodes where I've found a narrative and I'm like, this is a good story. Now I need to find out if it's true. And that is a really difficult thing to do if I've already got a good story in my head. Because I can have a great... There have been times where I've had great stories and I'm like, okay, now I need to look to see if this is true. And I need to make sure that I'm searching from the perspective of someone that does not believe that it's true so that I can get the right information. Because if I'm searching from the perspective of someone that believes it's true that's trying to sort of disprove it, I'm going to find different information than if I'm searching from the perspective of someone who doesn't believe it's true and is trying to disprove it. Because those are two very different things.
I find that a lot when I'm editing the live clips. And I have to go and evidence some of the things we've said. Is I go and find, like, search for something that one of us has claimed to be true, and then I find something that says that's not true, and I'm like, God damn it, I need to find something that says it is true. And then I'm like, no, Luke, that's not how this works.
Yeah, exactly.
So I just cut it out. I have to just cut it out.
It's so easy to find information that confirms your beliefs, right? Like, it's so easy to find that. That's what, there's so many common misconceptions, and I'm guilty of it too. Like, this happens, like, you can't know everything. So this happens a lot on, you know, on episodes or on lives. I'll say something that I probably learned in primary school, that I learned in high school, that I remember a teacher told me, that I remember someone told me, and then someone in the comments will be like, oh, this isn't true. And I'm like, well, gosh darn
Whoops.
It. Great. But when I go and search to see if it, whether it is true or not, there is a lot of, there are a lot of people who are under the impression that it is true, and you've got to then find the sort of factual evidence behind it. It is really, really difficult to do that. It's really difficult. And the fact that we're not trained to do it in school is understandable, because that's not what school is for. School is for setting you up to be a good little worker, but it would make society, you know, that kind of media literacy and ability to discern what information is sort of correct and what is not, and training people to be more adept at finding information that lies outside of their bias, I think would genuinely make the world a far better place.
That's one of the really exciting changes we're hopefully seeing in education over the next few decades, is moving away from a model of teaching information, because we literally have information in our pockets all the time, and moving towards teaching ways of thinking and how to learn and how to question and how, like, because like, so many of the problems we're seeing in our world is there's loads of evidence to suggest loads of the stuff we're doing is rubbish and loads of the things we're doing is based on untruths, and we have such large inertia that we just can't overcome it, despite the fact we've got plenty of evidence. So being able to set people up where, because right now, like, a load, like, all, you know, you've got a load of information in your brain from school, one that you don't need, but obviously the rationale behind that is like, but it's creating like a framework for your brain, as opposed to the specific information is creating like a framework and also teaching you to learn, of course. But imagine if the framework of your brain was based on like our best understanding of the world and how it works fundamentally, as opposed to, you know, just a bunch of biographical information about kings in the 16th century. Not that that's not interesting, and not that it's not, for, to many people that is perfectly interesting, but I think probably teaching people how to like not become fascists accidentally is probably more important.
Honestly, I find that really interesting, because like, this is the thing, I very much am of the belief that you need to, and this doesn't work for everyone, right, but it's something that I feel like I need to do in order for me to disagree with people, because I disagree with people publicly online a lot. That is kind of what I do. I need to understand their arguments so that I can argue against them, right?
Yeah.
If on like my other channels I'm laughing at something a conservative has said, if I'm saying, hey, Ben Shapiro is a big dummy, like, I need to understand what Ben Shapiro is saying so that I can say, hey, what Ben Shapiro is saying is ridiculous and you shouldn't listen to it. Yeah. And I find that so many people that not just follow Ben Shapiro, a lot of people that follow me as well, don't get to understand the opposing side's argument. And that, like, I've bought Jordan Peterson's book because I've been told Jordan Peterson is basically a gateway drug to fascism for a lot of young men. And I'm like, okay, interesting. Let's see why that is. Because I feel personally like I need to know. But I don't think that's something that is present in a lot of people. I feel like a lot of people will take the side of the people that they think sound better. And, you know, sometimes that can be, sometimes that you could get lucky and that could be for, like,
they'll take what feels right or
good. Yeah, but it's just, it is baffling to me how little people that try and sort of refute me online understand my arguments. It's honestly baffling. It really is. It's like you don't listen, you just disagree. It is just interesting that, I feel like the world that we're in is very much not set up to people, for people sort of looking to gain information or looking to sort of disprove what they believe. It's basically just taking whatever comes to you, essentially.
Confirming your biases. Like, you're looking for information to confirm your worldview as opposed to information to test your worldview.
Exactly. Look at the anti-vax movement. We've done an episode on this, right? We've done the anti-vax or anti-fax episode. Jemp, what number was that?
Oh, that was early. Is that in the 20s? I can't remember that one, actually.
I think it was 20s. Oh, sure.
Your first failure, Jack.
My first failure. I think it was in the 20s, like mid-20s-ish.
Cool. Let's say 25.
26? No, 25 is at the Albert.
Okay, watch every episode up to episode 25. until you get to...
It was episode 29.
Watch every episode up to episode 29.
There you go. And beyond that.
And yeah, watch this one too. No, so that's the thing. The anti-vax or anti-vax episode. We went over that. There is... It is indisputable that vaccines are safe, right? As a general rule, vaccines are safe. Not every single vaccine is going to be 100% safe. Right off the bat, there could be some issues and those get worked out. But like across the board, vaccines are a safe thing. You shouldn't be incredibly hesitant towards vaccines. We also know that vaccines don't cause autism. And yet that myth is perpetuated. And it's not perpetuated amongst the majority of doctors and scientists. It's perpetuated across Karens and Jessicas and Jennifers in Facebook groups.
Yeah.
It's people going up. It's not people releasing studies. It's people doing talks on this. And that's what baffled me when I found out about when I, you know, did that episode, when I looked into it, that the information that was there to support those claims was flimsy as all hell. You know, and that's, again, this comes up. I wanted to fully understand their side. I wanted to look at the strongest arguments that were being made. I wanted to find the people that were using evidence and convincing others. And I could not find that. The most I could find were like forum posts and some videos of talks. I had a friend from school whose mum was an anti-vaxxer.
Oh, no.
And I messaged him because I'm still good friends with him. And I said, hey, man, where do you get it? Where does this come from? And he said to me that, yeah, well, honestly, mostly what you see is them doing keynote speeches. You know, you can get those videos on YouTube.
God, yeah.
And it's just, it is baffling to me that like people don't look into that sort of stuff. They don't look into to see what the people that disagree with them say. And I feel like that is how a lot of people get drawn into the anti-vax movement, because they don't look into it beforehand, and they're drawn in by all of the strong arguments made on bloody Facebook groups and stuff, you know? I feel like we live in a world where people believe what they want to believe, and because information is so accessible, it is very easy to find information that confirms what you want to hear and what you want to believe. Like you were saying, I feel like education needs to pivot to being less about memorize these facts and more about here's how to discern truth and reality from lies and propaganda.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's so many psychological quirks that are left in us for, they're probably good at some point, but now that we're living as a community of 7 billion, probably 8 billion people, they're not very good. We're still designed to live in like a jungle.
it's horrifying. It's like, it's the sort of snake reflex as well. You know the snake reflex?
No,
that whole thing.
No,
I don't think it's specifically called the snake reflex, but this is something. And again, I want to put a caveat on this. Some of these details might be wrong. I'm kind of half remembering this, I think, from a PBS Eons thing or from somewhere, right? You know, so take this all with a grain of salt. But I do remember sort of reading or hearing somewhere that we have quite deeply ingrained in us. A lot of mammals have deeply ingrained in them this sort of fear or sort of this response to something that looks like a snake. Because obviously, snakes are very good hunters.
Oh, and so, like cats with cucumbers.
Yeah, cats with cucumbers. Yeah. And so, like, if you see something that looks like a snake, you're like, ah! Even if you've never seen a snake in your life, right? And it's just this automatic response that still happens, despite the fact that, honestly, who is that useful to?
Well, especially in Britain, it's not particularly useful here.
Oh, God, an adder. Oh, wait, never mind. It's
a grass snake.
Whoops. Wait, is it adders in the UK?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, boy, they do love their maths here. No, but that's the thing. There are really deeply ingrained things in us that just are kind of at this point kind of useless. But also, not to be conspiracy theory here, not to be sounding like, you know, crazy.
Oh God.
Oh dear.
I don't
Famous
think
last words.
Well, I don't think that I don't necessarily think it's in the best interests of the UK government to pivot education to being more like what we're saying, right? It doesn't seem to be, because to me right now, the UK government is, I'm not saying they're falling into fascism, but there are a lot of things that are no bueno that are being done by the UK government, and being able to get away with those things, a very easy way to do a lot of this is to keep your population uneducated about certain things. if you don't teach them about alternatives to capitalism, for example, your population is not going to be able to make any comments about the system that is exploiting them. If you sort of don't teach them about the wrongs of Winston Churchill, or the issues that of the UK and colonialism, then you stop them from being able to criticize their country as being, you know, like sort of violent. And it, to me, it really seems as though it, like, I can't imagine the current UK government really pushing for education to be pivoted to the way that we've spoken about in terms of discerning in, like, information and reality from propaganda, because they rely on propaganda to an extent, right, at this point. And they rely on people being ignorant about the past. They rely on, like, you know, if you don't, if you want to implement a law wherein protesting a statue can get you 10 years in prison, you probably don't want your population thinking, hey, maybe that guy shouldn't have a statue in the first place. Right? Like, it's just, I really hope we get to that point when with education. But to me, it doesn't seem like it's in the best interest of our current government
current
to do
times.
That. Yeah. And it's not just our government. It's many governments across the world. I mean, like, you know, look at the US instilling like nationalism in children from the age of 5.
Yeah. I think they instill nationalism in us, just not quite so overtly.
Yeah. We do have nationalism. I'm saying that we get nationalism instilled in us as well. I'm just saying it's not just us. America do it too. Plenty of other countries that do that also. It's just
France, I think, quite good at that.
God, yeah, France has been pushing, like, this is what's baffling to me. I've had Americans say to me, you live in a socialist country. All of Europe is socialist. And I'm like,
compared to, yeah.
France had a bloody burqa ban. Has a burqa ban. Right? Like, that's not socialist. It truly is not. Shall we get back to the Loch Ness Monster?
Oh, God.
Oh yeah, that's where we started.
I
reckon Nessie's a socialist.
She is socialist, right? She definitely is.
She doesn't socialize, but she is socialist.
Like, worst case, she's a libertarian, you know?
She's an NCAP.
Ugh, no. Don't do that. No. So Nessie, right? This whole story, Gemmell basically used it as publicity to sort of promote eDNA, which is fantastic, I think. So I've actually got some tweets from him here. And this is amazing. I kind of love this. That we run a science podcast here.
Yeah.
You know, we get to look at the history of science. We get to see scientists from hundreds of years ago and how they operated, you know, when they were basically just rich people that used their money in that way. And nowadays, running this science podcast, I don't need to, you know, do what they had to do ages ago and learn how to read Latin to understand all these books. I can go on to twitter.com, type in Neil Gemmell, and find a tweet thread that explains what was going on here, which I absolutely love, which ends in a Moana gif. Like, that is it is amazing.
What world are we living in?
I know. I love this world. It's great. So this is the tweet thread. It's just it's only 3 tweets long. It's very short. So he said, I get the odd message that queries the value of the Loch Ness work, with particular concern emerging about the use of taxpayer funding for an endeavor they see as frivolous. Fair enough. We all want our tax dollars put to good use. So just FYI, I'm paid through an empowered chair. The work was mostly funded by industry support and people donating their time and resources. We did $1 million+ project for 10,000s. The science is basic fundamental work that will have international resonance. It has been hard work, but it was most definitely fun, and it addressed a real science issue, generated publicity and advertising revenue for New Zealand and Otago worth many millions. Plus, it introduced eDNA to the world and switched on a new generation to science. So in short, you're welcome. The gift from the one.
Gonna say, except you're welcome.
It's fantastic. It's fantastic. I genuinely was so excited when I got to researching this story, when I found out that this was what was going on. I had a little bit of disappointment where I was like, oh, there is really nothing here. It's just a frivolous little study. And then I was like, oh, hold on. Wait, no, this is a bit more interesting than that. And you did some digging. I found his tweets and everything. It's just fantastic. So I'll just briefly go through what eDNA is. So, you know, I've kind of gone through it already, but I'll just touch on it really quickly again before we finish. So, you know, usually as you go around your life, you leave DNA about. I've said like, you know, your skin coming off, but also eggs, sperm, feces, all that stuff. That's got your DNA in it. And we can basically take little bits of DNA in the same way that we do it at crime scene stuff, CSI.
Oh, forensics.
Forensics, yeah. In the same way that we do with forensics, we take little bits of DNA and we can amplify it up and we can study that to see what it is. And we've got lots of different profiles of different animals' DNA. So we can be like, ah, this is the DNA of an eel, this is the DNA of a rabbit, and so forth. And the database, the reference database that we've got, so the database of sort of genomes for different animals, that has been increasing hugely, because DNA sequencing has gotten cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and quicker and quicker and quicker and quicker. And you can get more DNA out of very, very little, very easily. And this is all really cool stuff. And I studied this at uni. I find it incredibly fascinating. This is a revolution that most people don't know about, right? Most people probably aren't aware of these bounds and leaps and bounds that are being made in DNA research, but it is absolutely fantastic. We're building up massive, massive libraries of DNA of everything that we can, right? We're taking different animals and building up libraries of their genomes. So now we're basically getting to a point where, you know, we can use this sort of eDNA, DNA that is just left in an environment, to figure out what is living there. And it is fantastic. So the U.S. National Institutes of Health has a DNA sort of a DNA database, and it's doubled every 18 months since 1982. It has more than 260 trillion base pairs of DNA across more than 200 million sequences. It's incredible. And
that's stored digitally, is it, or is that samples of DNA, actual physical samples?
That'll be super stored digitally. Yeah, that's. I'm not laughing at you. I'm picturing, like, if they were to try and store it sort of physically, that would degrade. So DNA is a good molecule in people's bodies, but that stuff degrades so fast. No, like, you can keep that digitally, and it's literally, we've been over this. It's so easy to keep it digitally because it's such a simple code. It's A, C, G, and T. You can literally store that in a plain text file if you wanted to.
Yeah.
It is fantastic. You could do it in an Excel file. It's so cool. I love this so much. I just get so excited about this kind of stuff. And again, this sort of eDNA stuff, it's basically taking soil samples, water samples, and being able to get a sort of picture of what is living there. Instead of having to, you know, do surveys, there's this whole idea where you put down different squares and you see what's in the square, or you take organisms back to the lab. In this case, you just take a sample. You take it back to the lab and you study that.
Wow.
It's incredible. People are making a lot of discoveries from it. It's kind of exploded since 2011. And right now, the National Geographic Society is trying to extract DNA from a soil sample from the South Pacific island of Nicu Maroro to see if a gravesite that is there is that of Amelia Earhart, the woman who was lost when she was sort of flying across, I think, the Pacific Ocean. Yeah.
Wow.
So that is the story of Nessie and eDNA and, you know, the potential eel that could be the Loch Ness Monster.
Very good.
So that is that. I mean, we've maybe got a little quick fire quiz for you.
Dun, 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 dun.
Oh, we got this.
Loch Ness edition.
So the rules are the same as always. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. I will ask one question between the two of you. I have to finish asking the question before you can buzz in with your answers. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer wins. What do they win, champ?
Nothing.
Gosh darn right. Luke, what is your buzzer?
Flippy, flippy, floppy, floppy.
Very good buzzer.
Sound of a big eel.
Jamp, what is your buzzer?
Boop, 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 boop. Which is the bubbles coming up.
It.
From the eel?
Yeah, from the eel.
Fantastic.
The eels breathe air. Whoever. I assume they do. Yeah.
Wait.
No, they won't.
No,
the eels won't breathe air, Jamp. They're water creatures. No, but they won't have bubbles.
No, but Nessie breathes bubbles.
Nessie breathes bubbles. Okay.
Even though she's most likely an eel.
Yeah.
My question for you today is, that fake picture of Nessie in the 30s, what was it actually?
Floppy, 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 floppy.
Jamp, I think that was you.
I believe it was a toy submarine and some putty of some kind.
Ding, ding, ding. That is correct. Yes! Well done.
Wow. Well done.
It was not the Loch Ness Monster. It was a toy submarine and some wood putty.
Thank you. Well, wood putty, that was it.
Yeah, wood putty. I think that's it from us. Anything you guys want to add to this? We had a bit of a big discussion here today, didn't we?
Well, I'd just like to ask, Jam, could you say the name of the monster, please?
Loch Ness Monster.
No.
Nessie.
No.
Loch Ness.
Loch.
Loch Ness.
Loch. Loch.
My mum used to drill into me, it's Loch, Loch. Not Loch.
Loch. I resigned myself before we did this. I don't know if you noticed, I feel like I've gone more Scottish with this one, but...
Yeah. You said no, you definitely a few times, Scottish, which you don't often say.
I resigned myself to the fact that I'm going to have people correcting me on the pronunciation. I was born and raised in Scotland. I can say it however I like, to be honest.
Well, when they say that, we can just time code them to this time code where we talk about that exact thing.
Very good.
I grew up in Australia where we called it the Loch Ness Monster.
Loch Ness Monster.
Loch Ness Monster.
Loch Ness Monster.
Down in the water, in the Loch Ness.
It's in a place called Loch Ness. In Scotland. Yeah, in Scotland.
Monster in the water. Yeah.
There's no bloody dingoes out there. You won't find any.
I reckon it's just a dingo that's got lost.
It's just a dingo, isn't it? A dingo's tail. Gotta be
fantastic. Well, I think that's it for us today. Nothing else that we can add. Thank you very much for watching this episode. We would like to thank all of our patrons with a very special thank you to our executive producers, Ashley Muller and Finn TZ. And also, thank you for watching. You can find the full references for this episode in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Sunday, and why not leave us a nice wee review or a comment too? You can support us at patreon.com/SciGuys or find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, and at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCorey everywhere.
You can follow me at Jamkin everywhere.
You can follow me at LukeCutforth everywhere.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.